Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 844. Let's take a stroll over to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. First, selfishly, I'd like to promote a couple things. At Midnight, we'll be back January 3rd. I will be co-hosting live with Kelly again the 4th, 5th, and 6th. So make a quick trip to New York for that. And also The Wall. I think a lot of people watched it the other night when it was on NBC. Really emotional. I mean, I watched it again. I knew it was going to happen, and I got choked up watching it on my computer in my office on the NBC feed. But we are coming back for a two-night premiere, January 2nd and 3rd, and then The Wall will be in its regular time slot on 8 p.m. on Tuesdays, starting on the 3rd. So 2nd and 3rd January, that. And and then January, boy, everything is back up and running. This podcast documentary that some friends of mine made, Graham Elwood, Chris Mancini, of course you probably know from Comedy Film Nerds, they made a podcast documentary called Earbuds. It is now available for you to buy. This is a great, fun documentary about the world of podcasting. I did some stuff for it. Everyone you know, if you're a podcast fan, did stuff for it. And it connects fans on a really personal level. So go to earbudspodmovie.com to see it now. But they're such great guys, and I'm glad that it finally is out. Also, Diego Aldape writes, "My name is Diego. I'm a Mexican Nerdist fan. I did a thing. I developed a show called The Geek Life MX, in which I showcase geek life in Mexico, Monterrey, Mexico specifically, and or now I probably should say Mexico. So I apologize, Monterrey, Mexico, and all the different subcultures that make up geek culture. Unfortunately, due to a severe lack of budget, my project was canceled a couple years ago, but I recently got a friend to help me edit all the raw footage, and we finally finished it. Fair warning, it's mostly in Spanish, because Mexico, but doesn't everyone need a little Spanish in their lives? Yes. I plan on adding English subtitles so everyone can enjoy it. The Facebook page and YouTube channel are both The Geek Life MX. Well done. Muy bien, Diego. And muchas gracias, I would say. I really need to learn how to speak better Spanish. Diego, I'm going to follow you, and then I'm going to watch the documentary in Spanish, and I'm going to learn geek lingo en español. It's time. This episode is Neil Finn, who is legitimately one of my musical heroes. I've been a Crowded House fan. Well, even before Crowded House, Split Enz, then Crowded House, then Neil Finn solo stuff. I've seen him play so many times. Scott Aukerman and I used to go together, and Scott was actually the one that tipped me off that he was going to be in town. He's always been on the permanent, if you can ever get Neil Finn, please try to get him, to our booker, Deb. And Scott said, hey, Neil's going to be in town. So thank you to Scott Aukerman for that, and always follow all of Scott Aukerman's stuff. And thank you to Neil Finn for agreeing to do it. So we went to the studio at SIR, and we chatted, and then I was in this weird position where he was like, I'll play whatever you want. So here I am with, like, literally one of my musical heroes saying, I'll play whatever you want. It's that sort of weird fever dream that you have sometimes where you go, what if? And it happened. Thankfully, I had made a list, a very comprehensive list, which I'm sure was embarrassing, I'm sure, on every level for me to just break out this list and go, here's this one and this one and this one. But I am genuinely such a huge fan, and Neil is such a sweet, sweet, sweet guy. So we traded emails. He played Largo the next couple of days. So I went to his Largo show And he played a couple songs at SIR, which was great. And then, see, I was trying to avoid asking him to play Don't Dream It's Over, which he said he would totally play. But I just felt bad. I just didn't, you know, like I feel like a lot of people ask him to play that song. So I really wanted to pick some of my personal favorites that I connected with personally. But then at Largo, he played Don't Dream It's Over with Mitchell Froom, who Mitchell was their producer for, and also played keyboards. He's the one that played the really infamous keyboard stuff on Don't Dream It's Over. And he hadn't played with them for a long time, and he was at Largo and then played it. And the song was just incredible. So I emailed Neil and I said, look, I know you've already done all these great things for me. Could I convince you to let me use the Largo recording of Don't Dream It's Over? And he said yes. So that's, there are three songs at the end. Two of them are Neil in, just Neil and a guitar at SIR Studios. And then the last one is the full Don't Dream It's Over. It was Neil and his son Liam Finn, who's also fantastic. If you don't know his stuff, you should check it out. And, you know, his band, not Crowded House, but Neil and his band, and Mitchell Froom. So there you go. I'm very excited about this episode. And it was just another one of those, how do I get to do these things? How am I lucky enough to get to talk to these people that I've idolized my whole life? So here you go. That's the whole, that's all backstory. Thanks to for them for sponsoring this episode, which is Neil Finn, who I think I'm kind of pals with now. Oh my God. This is a fucking dream. And I will not dream that it's over. Shit. Yeah. That was not cringy. That was good. You know it was good. Because it was natural and it was organic. So you can just shut up about it. All right. Nerds Podcast number 844. Neil Finn, KD, please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's just such an epic tale of survival.
Should I sit opposite you? Is that a
sure?
Good idea?
Yeah, yeah.
We just had the pleasure of being able to. Well, we had Mick Fleetwood came and did some drumming on some recent work, so in Auckland. So we got some great stories, and he's a very charming man.
Was he already? You got him to come to New Zealand?
He was in New Zealand with Fleetwood Mac, and I ran into him, and I'd met him once before, and he. He was just enthusing about New Zealand and also about, you know, maybe doing something together at some point. I went, well, actually, we're doing a session in February, and why don't you just... He lives in Hawaii, so it's not a huge...
Oh, it's not that bad, yeah.
It's 8 hours, which...
yeah, but he's still...
For us, it's nothing, you know. but he came at a good time, so he came down and had a 10-day session.
So when Mick Fleetwood comes into the studio with you, do you say, well, yeah, I guess just do whatever you want, or do you give him direction, or how does it work?
Look, he's by far the tallest person in the room, so you give him anything you want.
Anything he wants.
And he himself admits he's very dyslexic, and so he actually doesn't. I don't know why that affects his memory, but he will play what he plays.
Right.
If you told him to do a particular fill going into the second chorus, there's no way he would get that.
Right.
Once he learns it on his own terms, he can repeat what he did. But no, and that's what's the beauty of it. Every take he does is a different beast. So we were quite happy to leave him to it, you know.
And so you kind of the whole time this is happening, if you shut your eyes, you go, yeah, that's Mick Fleetwood. Like, is he basically doing Mick Fleetwood-isms within the language of the song?
He is. You recognize certain fills that you love from Fleetwood Mac records, and then strange diversions. You know, in the middle of a verse, you'll suddenly go off on some fill, and it's very willful but amazing in someone who's been around for so long. He's still got a real sort of childlike approach to making music, and enthusiasm, and sits there till the end of the day and listens to the minutiae of the take that just happened, and make suggestions, and yeah, he's totally enthused and engaged, and he was a joy. Yeah,
I've been able to see you perform a number of times in a number of different venues. I've seen you, I'm pretty sure I've seen a Crowded House show, but I've seen Finn Brothers. I saw you play with Johnny Marr and Wendy and Lisa at their House of Blues.
That's right, yeah.
And it, my impression is that you are just a music generating machine
who then just goes on tour and then expresses all of these things, and you go back home and write, and then you go back out on tour. Does it feel that way to you, or do you feel like, I don't really do stuff most of the time? It feels like you're an incredibly prolific performer.
Well, I'm glad it feels like I'm prolific, because sometimes I feel like I'm nowhere near get enough stuff out. You know,
really?
Like, yeah, well, I mean, you've got to live a life as well. You've got to take stuff in, so you can't just be completely one-dimensional. Occasionally, when I've been in the studio for 3 months, I do feel like I've lost my ability to relate to the world a little bit. You've got to get out and have some experience. I'm lucky to have a great family, and they're pretty much all the entertainment I need, and all the sort of, you know, checks and balances are, as a human being, covered with them, really. I don't get ahead of myself. But I'm just in a big hurry to get as much work done as I possibly can, as long as it's good. But I'm also quite slavish about making sure that it's you know, well-conceived and well-rendered, and the art is in making it seem easy, but sometimes it's really not, you know, so you've got to
have to figure out how to make it seem like it's...
You've got to make it sound like it was the easiest thing in the world, but the struggle involved in that sometimes is quite epic.
I mean, most, you know, and I've heard a lot of people, you know, like really people that you, I assume, would absolutely respect go, oh, Neil Finn is the guy, like he's the guy, he writes, because you're... songs, they always go into a place, it's, you know, it's kind of moving along and then like, oh, how did he think to go there? There's always some twist. There's always some Neil Finn twist where the chords go in an unexpected direction. Do you automatically feel it that way, or do you have to noodle with stuff until you find something that feels interesting?
Well, I've allowed it to remain a mystery. There's no code or manual particularly for me. And I don't know if there is for anybody, but one thing I'm always conscious of is making the song move forward and keep you engaged. And so I suppose for that, I mean, I would like to think that my middle eights are always really strong. You know, like I'm known for my middle eights. It's a strange thing to be known for. But I'm always really conscious of that place in the song where you're going to be taken somewhere that's unexpected, a beautiful release or some little tweaking some nerve that you didn't know you had, you know. But ultimately it is a mystery because you're trying to make people feel something. You have to make yourself feel something first. There's little moments of revelation after a lot of banal experimenting where you suddenly get a little shiver up your spine because something's tweaked a nerve for you and you go, well, I'm expecting that there's people will feel that too. So you
right.
just follow that thread as much as you can. And actually the trick that I've learned, which is the hardest one of all, is to keep going at that time and make as many gains as you can while you're following that thread, because the temptation is to go pretty quickly after that with a little nice piece on tape going, oh, that's great, that's going to be a great idea, that's going to be a great song, I'm going to go and have a little cup of tea now as a
right.
reward or a beer or something, and then you come back and it's not so easy after a little while. So yeah, you got to follow that thread at the time.
And that is
get words down.
You're pretty disciplined. Are you pretty disciplined about that?
No, I'm hopeless at it. Yeah, I'm always conscious of it, but I just haven't completely captured that theory and made it into practice yet.
But there's so many Crowded House songs are, you know, obviously, "Don't Dream It's Over" is just a part of our cultural fabric. But there are so many Crowded House songs that are very anthematic. You know, I think. Something So Strong is just a very celebratory, anthematic. I mean, was that representative of stuff that you were going through at the time, or you were just fresh out of Split Ends and, you know, kind of ready to plant your stake in the ground? I mean, what was going on emotionally?
Well, I was highly motivated at the end of Split Ends, because at the end of any band, there's always a tremendous amount of frustration. But the bonds that connect bands are really deep. If you're in band for 5 or 6 years, the chances are you'll still be arguing about ridiculous things about 20 or 30 years later.
And in a band with your brother.
And a band with my brother. That's another relationship that's really complex, yeah. So, in the sort of aftermath of Split Ends breaking up, there'd been all this frustration and things not working very well and properly. And, you know, we were good friends. There wasn't any huge, you know, bad feelings. But there was weird unspoken things, and bands are not honest with each other generally. They kind of circle around each other. And
is that to protect each other's egos or protect their own egos?
Conscious of each other's egos
right.
and not upsetting the apple cart, yeah. And
then the agents start talking and then
yeah,
people
then
are talking.
That's about... another layer, yeah, that's right. But that does create a sort of energy in the end. When you release yourself from that, as I did, and with Paul Hester on board,
sure.
just the two of us, we talked about let's be in a small band. It was a six-piece split end, so that was one of the first things we decided. Small band, all fit in one car, and keep the problems relatively simple, you know. And we found Nick Seymour, who was a really big burst of energy. And the other thing, I'd been in a band with guys who were 6 years older than me, my brother's friends, and it was great, and it was a great education for me. And I was always the youngest, always sent down to the shop to buy the sandwiches. You know, that was it was good for me, and well, it kept me humble. But then Paul was the same age as me, and so was Nick. So suddenly I was in a bunch of – in the one car with a bunch of guys my own age, and we were laughing about the same things. And there was a lot of energy from that period. And, you know, we went to L.A. just on a blind mission, really, to see if we could get a deal. We found a deal at Capitol, and we – found a producer that I'd never worked with a real producer like Mitchell Froom was, that really got involved in songs and songwriting. And he was the one who actually made something so strong into a kind of an upbeat R&B, with an R&B bass line, I mean loosely R&B, from a pop point of view. But before that, it was kind of a pastoral little folk song that I'd written. And actually on the reissues that are coming out at the end of this year, there's a whole bunch of bonus material, one of which is two demos I made of that particular song, Something So Strong, showing the sort of you know, journey it took from small little pastoral twee folk song to, you know, upbeat, rollicking, R&B-based pop.
And is that is a lot of that just in being able to trust your producer? Because to me, it seems like one of the most stressful things is a song can go in a million different directions, and it can be expressed in a million different ways. So yeah. How do you know, like, okay, this is the one, and I guess we should cut those other parts and make it this new thing that we hadn't intended?
Well, in some cases, glorious accident occurs really quickly. The band will take it and play it in a manner that wasn't expected by me. That's a great thing about bands, is that, you know, they can't play your ideas the way you would play them. So sure. Initially you may go, oh, I didn't mean it to be, and then you go, oh, actually, that's maybe that's a little better. I think that opens little cracks in the armor of a song and allows light in somehow. Not sure if that makes sense. But when you work on your own entirely, which sometimes I do and other people have made, you can make some great work, but it has a kind of a sealed feeling about it, like it's an impenetrable thing. You know, you're playing every instrument. It's like beauty you can't kind of reach into and grab hold of. I think when a band plays something, the mixture of personalities means that you've got some texture and you've got some depth that you didn't even imagine yourself. So, you know, I'm a great fan of collaboration bands. You know, people who aren't necessarily experts either. I think people who are struggling at the edge of their abilities play better than people for whom it's too easy.
Right, yeah. Well, you're also hungrier when you're – because you're trying to elevate.
Yeah.
And so how do you – you know, like when you've been playing music and you feel it and you've achieved so much, how do you keep that hunger fresh and how do you keep that drive, you know, when you could, I would imagine, like, you know, I'm good for money. I have a family. I could just not do anything for a long time. Like how do you find the drive to go through it all again?
Well, it's just compulsive, really, because when you hit those moments of transcendence with music, it's like one of the best feelings in the world, and that's compulsive. And there's also, as time goes on, I sort of feel like in our own humble way, musicians have got a really important role to play out there. And so, it's juggling that feeling that this is the most important thing in the world with all the time being completely aware of its cosmic insignificance. You know, like there's something between those two points of view that's you've got to remain, you know, like, because none of it matters at all, really, in terms of life and death and the cosmos and all that. But music is one of the most positive things that we've got on the planet, and God knows there's so much that's completely messed up and, you know, jarring, nerve-jangling things happening in the world. Music is even more important now, I think. And there's great music around still somehow in the midst of all this crazy unreality and distraction. People are making great music, so it makes me believe in human beings, you know, to hear it.
Was it did the amount of success off the first album feel oppressive in any way? Like, oh my God, how are we going to do that again? You know, like what is the – I mean, because it really was – I know the first album was 1986, right? And so for a couple of years – you know, when the music business was much different and an album could really breathe for like a year or two. Like, I remember MTV, you know, I guess
it was slowly, really different, yeah.
Slowly rolled out every song. Oh, the Crowded House song, it's great, you know. And now it just feels like everything just burns really fast. But at the time, I mean, you know, when that first album came out, it was everywhere, and it was so much a part of all of pop culture. And, you know, did you feel a way to that? And did it feel like any more pressure? Or were you just excited to go back in and do it again?
Well, it's anyone who's had a moment of success like that in whatever field of the entertainment industry has to go through that, because there's a composite range of skills that it takes to become successful, I think, over a long period of time especially. And it kind of helps if you're interested in the idea of being successful and being a celebrity,
mm-hmm.
and you do it, and you're prepared to do it well, and you don't resent the intrusion and the attention that you get. But that is an adjustment, there's no doubt. We're excited to be having, to be part of the zeitgeist or part of the moment. You know, you hear your song coming from a window of a car that's pulling up next to you at the lights. It's a great feeling, it really is. But and shows are celebratory, and you know, there's a feeling of this is a really exciting moment in our lives. It comes with another range of emotions. One, I was feeling a little guilty that my new band was having all the success with my old band. You know, for my brother and for my old bandmates, I kind of couldn't enjoy it as much as I should have. And also
Catholic guilt. That's exactly what that is.
And it's exactly guilt. What it is, yeah. Are you a Catholic?
I was raised Catholic. Oh, you Catholic understand. School, yeah. And yeah. I know you were raised pretty
Catholic. Well, I was raised Catholic, yeah. I'm seriously lapsed at this point. But,
me too. Absolutely. I feel like most people that I talk to that are raised Catholic, like if they went to Catholic school, like, oh, yeah, I lapsed a long time ago.
But I think there's something in that upbringing that makes you, I don't know, I think there's some good stuff goes on there.
Absolutely.
Some good neurosis, a little bit of good, the guilt is not even a bad thing. There's some good subject material for songs there, and
sure.
The imagery's great, you know. I don't feel bitter about it, that's it.
That's good.
I wasn't badly abused anywhere or, you know, like, thankfully.
But I feel like at least the people that I know that are from New Zealand, you know, the Concords or Rhys Darby or Taika mm-hmm. Waititi, like all these, they're such... The mood seems to be, and I don't know if they're representative of all New Zealanders, but very laid back and kind of like, well, you know, just kind of take it as it comes, and this seems, you know, and not super stressy.
No. Well, it's sort of laid back and relaxed and deadpan in a way that plays well, I think, in America, where things are generally, people have the impression that you need to be more outgoing, pumped up.
Right.
To get successful, to get noticed, you know. In New Zealand, you don't grow up thinking you're going to be noticed anyway because it's so far away from everywhere. But there is a sort of underlying anxiety and sort of insecurity underneath, and all those guys might testify to that as well. They're breaking out, definitely. But I think one thing that I grew up in an unusual situation because my brother was in the strangest band that's ever been in the way they looked. And before I joined Split Enz, they really were an extraordinarily strange band. You know, like the music was really weird. The image was incredibly weird. So I grew up in this arch conservative country with this role model of guy with a mohawk. You know, this was 1976. My mother would have to explain to her friends when he'd come around. And, you know, it was one of those. So I probably had a really nice, and we were looking at the world through rose-colored spectacles. You know, you have romantic ideas of what Hollywood's like or what, you know, the marquee club in London was like. And I think that serves you quite well because you always walk into a big city and are slightly wide-eyed. But also, you know, and I think those guys you talk to, there's a little bit of not that impressed with the things that are the shallow aspects of the culture, but
right.
really, really interested in the deep, the things that have gone on in places like America with the music and the culture and the films and the comedy, really deep connection with that stuff. But that seems like another layer underneath everyday life when you get here. And so, you just sort of walk around a bit wide-eyed and deadpan.
Even with the Concords, I just remember, I always thought, I know I've said this on the podcast before, but you know, like the day they found out their show was picked up for HBO, they got a call. They're like, hey, your show's picked up. And Jermaine was like, oh, that's great. We're eating. Like, they just wanted to finish their lunch. And just like anyone else I know would be like, what?
Yeah.
You know, so it's – I respect that. And I feel like it's probably way healthier to be that way.
Well, they're really fine and well-balanced people. And I know them a little bit too. And they're really wonderful company. And, yeah, I think they deserve their success apart from the talent. You don't begrudge them a thing. You know, like they're not – putting themselves out there like the be all and end all, like young gods.
is there a
even though they are, is there, they are gods.
Is there like a Kiwi brotherhood where it's like if anyone kind of blows up outside of your own community, it's like, oh, we all kind of, You know, like
there's a lot of jealousy, and you know, tall poppy syndrome is alive and well in New Zealand. Yeah, completely. But I think the good friends that you have stay with you, you know, no matter what. Well, the great thing about when they blew up here is that suddenly it was being a New Zealander and standing in the middle of a group of people and really not saying hardly anything, just going, yeah, was suddenly quite credible. You know, like it was a good way to behave, and people thought that was hilarious because you had the right accent. You know, you were a little bit like Murray, being a little bit like Jermaine.
Right.
Not having to really work that hard. It really did us all a favor. It made, you know, New Zealand Reserve seem like a thing.
Well, I don't ever comment on other people's Facebook pages, but someone sent me your performance of Don't Dream It's Over from Australian 60 Minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And the first comment was this woman, and she was very enthusiastic. Oh, I love this band. They're my favorite Australian band. I want to be like, they're not Australian. Like, I almost got really mad on your behalf.
Well, people get more mad than we do. You know, I don't really care. You know,
well, like, I know, but I just assume, like, you know, this just seems like kind of it's like a willful ignorance. Like, well, you don't know that they're Australian. They're just, you know, like, is there a competitive identity between New Zealand and Australia that you're aware of?
There's some fun to be had with it. You know, to harken back to the Concords, one of my favorite episodes they did was where they went and stood outside the Australian embassy in New York and give the fingers to the guard outside. And actually, they had
Darby.
No. His name slipped my mind. Master of None. What's his name?
Oh, Aziz Ansari.
Aziz Ansari, yeah, sorry. Yeah, they had him on this. It was just that episode he was on.
Right.
It was about racism, but it was about racism between New Zealanders and Australians, which was quite – and I'd never seen that done before. No, New Zealanders are really bugged by the fact that Australia claims credit for a lot of New Zealand things.
Sure.
Sam Neill, you know actually, they're not so bothered about Russell Crowe. They're okay about being taken by the Aussies. But Crowded House, you know – it's a difficult thing to navigate for me because I feel I'm a New Zealander. I live in Auckland, and I feel, you know, that I've never really had anything else to say about where I'm from. But we started in Melbourne, so I've got a great affinity for Australia, and the band was treated, you know, we've got a really good thing in Australia, and I kind of flattered that they consider that I'm, you know, honorary Australian. I think it's like being adopted by another family, you know, by your wife's family or something. So I try to stay out of that particular debate. It does get, you know, Australians a little bit like they're a little bit like we don't think about that too much because that's New Zealand. That's
right.
Little guys, you know, we don't have to think about that.
Right.
Which irks the New Zealanders. They sometimes spend too much time thinking about it.
I'm desperate to go to New Zealand.
It's just across the water.
I know. Well, I just got married and we went to Japan for our honeymoon and we thought, oh, well, you know, Japan wasn't a terribly long flight. We survived it fine. New Zealand's not that much farther.
It's a long, but it's overnight. That's the good thing. They organize the flights well. They're overnight, so you can sort of sleep. It's 12 hours, so it's a big flight. But it's, I just feels to me like getting in a car and driving to the shop now. Like it really is so normal to get on that flight.
Is December a good time to go? We were thinking about going over the holidays.
Yeah, it's a great time. Early summer, sometimes it's unpredictable weather-wise, but it's warm and, yeah, it's beautiful. Anytime's good. The most stable time of year. But then you live in California, so you want weather.
Right.
You want to go away and get some weather, right? You don't want fine days every day.
We get real sensitive real quick. So it's like, you know, we're so spoiled here with our weather and we go other places and like, hey, you know, let's go see winter. And then it'll snow for a second. You're like, fuck, I got it.
It's sludge now.
Yeah. It's gray. What is this gray? How do you survive this gray? You get spoiled here very, 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 very quickly.
Well, we're enjoying it. We've been here for the last 3 weeks, my wife and I, and hanging out. Our son lives in Silver Lake.
Liam?
His wife, yeah.
I loved his album too, by the way.
Thank you. I loved it too. And I'll pass that on. They've just had a baby, actually. We're pretty excited about that.
Oh, you're grandparents.
So, yeah, I am, yeah.
That's nice.
Which is an incredible joy, I must say. It gets a good rap from people, and they always say, with look in their eyes, like, you get all the pleasure and you get to sleep well as well.
You don't have all the responsibility.
And it's true, yeah. So we're enjoying that at the moment. And we haven't had one. Oh, there was a bit of rain 2 days ago. It rained for about five minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, a second.
Big drops.
Big drops. Everyone ran inside.
It was like 10 seconds between them.
Falling out of space, and then it was everything was fine. And then we breathed a sigh of relief again.
I never forget the first time I was in LA, and there was a rain. It rained for probably an hour, I think. And we were watching TV, and they crossed to the helicopter, and they were storm chasing on the helicopter. They were actually filming rain, drops of rain from a helicopter.
If it rains for more than a couple days in a row, they'll send some intern, like some low-level reporter who's trying to, you know, get their wings on the reporting staff. Like, they'll send him out to Malibu and put him in, like, a poncho, and they'll just stand there in the rain and go, I know, the surf's crazy. People are trying to, you know, these potholes. You know, L.A. was just not designed for rain, so the roads get real bad real fast, and people just don't know how to handle it.
Well, I mean, you know, when dust gets wet after weeks of sitting on there, it's going to get slippery,
Yeah, but still, I mean, I still feel like we're incredibly spoiled here.
Well, it is, and it's wonderful, really. It's an amazing environment. We used to find L.A. very mysterious back in the day because we would always be in a hotel on Sunset Boulevard and really can't walk anywhere that feels like any kind of community or whatever. But as soon as we got to know people and we went to people's houses, and then even more so now with our son living in Silver Lake and that being real, there's a real community sense there. And, you know, you go, I think people are on it. They must be on some kind of really good medication, because you go to the supermarket, the people are so happy working in the supermarket. I mean,
oh, yeah, that's medication.
What, is it? Do you think?
Sure, that's medication.
Yeah. I mean, they say, have you had a good day shopping, sir?
That's so nice. I just feel like
quite good, yeah. And it's
I feel like the median emotion in LA is, I hope no one laughs in my face and tells me I'm a piece of shit. I'm just trying to do, you know, I feel like everyone's just scared and trying to.
I don't know. People seem extraordinarily friendly at the moment.
Oh, good.
But
I'm glad to hear that.
It might be that neighborhood is a very tolerant, wonderful community neighborhood.
It is. It's nice. Silver Lake, you know, Silver Lake's one of those neighborhoods that bounced back. And, you know, it was like an art community kind of sprung out of it. It used to, you know, the neighborhood kind of ran down. And then, then they start putting in their artisan coffee shops. And then, like, artists start moving in. And then, you know, they kind of form their own little community. So the L.A. is really a collection of those. It's a collection of
And within those, there are communities. See, that's the thing you don't hook into straight away. And it seems so vast and just ringed by freeways and, you know, like, quite intimidating. It took me a long time. But the other thing that made me connect to the place was finding Largo, because that became a little home away from home. Every time I came in, I'd go down and hang out and get up with John Bryan or a show myself. And, you know, both the old place, Fairfax, and the new place.
I've been doing comedy at Largo since 1997.
Yeah.
So I love the new space, and I love that Flanny made the little tiny room as an homage to the old Largo.
Yeah.
But I really do. There was something about the old Largo that was just unexpected, and it's like, what is this kind of weird hole in the wall? And then you go in, and it's basically this kind of nice pub.
I had some
brilliant
nights there. Yeah, incredible. And it's so dark, you don't even know who's there.
Right.
Which is great. And all of a sudden, you're there one night, and like John's up there, and he's starting to build some weird loop thing, and you don't know what it is at first. And then you realize it's all the young dudes, and Ian Hunt is sitting next to you. You go, oh, wow. And you can see Ian Hunt, he's going, his mouth's open, and he's going, what the?
Yeah, because that room only held like maybe 150 people or 200 people.
Yeah.
There was no backstage. You got to the stage from basically the front door through the kitchen. You go through the back that way.
It was a great community came out of there. Like Elliot Smith, you know, you'd see him there quite often. And just really, really great bunch of people.
Amy Mann, Colin Hay. It was a really nice, special.
And Van Montanche is a regular there and stuff. It was a really good little community. And it made L.A. feel really friendly for me all of a sudden, you know, somewhere to go.
Is it refreshing for you to find places like that to balance out, you know, when you have to do like a real presentational show, like in a huge theater or an arena or something? Is it kind of feel nice? Like, you know, performing for like 150, 200 people, it kind of grounds me. Does it feel that way?
I love that environment. I end up doing shows at Largo almost every time I'm in LA. And in fact, it must be a bit galling for people. I've got people who will fly from Seattle to come down to the Largo shows, and they must by now be going, well, I mean, if you came to Seattle, I wouldn't have to do this. But actually, we did come there. There's a lot of places we don't get to, unfortunately. I feel a little bit like I've removed myself from some of the areas, not deliberately. It's just that they turn up on tour schedules, and you go, well, it'd be nice to get to Texas this time even. And they just end up, the timings don't get work or whatever, but it is a regular place for me to try out new songs, as it is for comedians to try out new material.
Yes, yes.
It's a really familiar environment. We're doing a couple coming up soon again, and there's a nice unpredictability about it, and people will forgive any amount of looseness. I can decide to do a song that I don't even really remember and people won't hold it against me.
Right.
I love that sort of state of performance anyway, where you're on the edge of your seat. You know, it's always been, it was the way that we used to perform with Crowded House. It's the way that I like performing. Too much formality is a vibe killer for me. So
yeah.
Largo has it in spades.
So how do you know, how do you sort of feel like, you must have songs that you want to do, but you know that there are songs that the crowd wants to hear.
Mm.
So how do you, every time you tour, decide what the playlist is going to be? Like, okay, you know, I saw Beck at the Orpheum a couple of years ago, and he said at the top of the show, all right, I'm going to do like 7 new songs, and then I'll play all the stuff that I know you guys are already know. Mm. And it was a really interesting way to do it, because everyone was very engaged in the first 7 songs, and then it's like, okay, and then he did, you know, Devil's Haircut.
It's a good little, real pro move that. Beck would know, he knows some good pro moves at this point. I haven't quite tried that one, but it is quite good. I think Radiohead are just doing exactly the same thing at the moment. They're playing 6 of the new songs on their record
right
up front. It is quite good. I think people understand the premise, so they'll stay with you, and then knowing that they're not going to get shafted later on, you know.
Right. I've always wanted to know how it feels to play, you know, when you have a song like Don't Dream It's Over and you know that everyone knows it and you've played it for 30 years, do you still feel the same joy, or do you feel like, oh, I guess I better do this? Or how do you keep that fresh and new? And
I really enjoy playing Don't Dream It's Over. I always have. And thankfully, all the songs there's a couple of things maybe that you get a bit tired of on a course of a tour that don't wear as well. I won't say what they are, but Don't Dream It's Over is not one of those. I really enjoy singing it and playing it, and I don't think I'll ever get sick of it. I'm relieved that the songs I became known for as a young man are not impossible to sing or do the moves for. You know, like, I think if you're known for, I guess if you're a punk rocker or something, and it gets tough when you get to 60. You
know?
You've got to maintain that energy. I mean, Iggy Pop does it magnificently, but there's probably quite a few who can't manage it. So, I'm glad. You know, my songs by and large, I'm happy to sing ballads. I love slow, sad songs. I always did.
Lullaby Requiem is one of my favorite songs.
Oh, thank you.
Of all time, one of my favorite songs.
Well, it was written, you know, shortly after my mother passed away, so it was a deeply felt one. So, yeah.
Do you find more inspiration to write and express stuff, sad things or happy things, or is it just sort of a balance of both?
It's in some ways, for me anyway, it's easier to dip into melancholia as a starting point for a song, because it's a kind of feeling that I enjoy from music myself. Always did, even when I was a pretty carefree 14-year-old and I didn't have a care in the world. I just loved sad, you know, slow, sad songs. But then you get into the habit in a band of thinking, well, we're going to need some up songs, so we better make sure a few of them are up-tempo. And
sure.
And I probably still have that lurking in there a little bit. But I don't know. If you ask people that really like my music, I think there's a good chance that most of them would be relating. Their favorite songs might be the medium to low to slow songs. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever.
When you went into the studio, Crowded House really was like, it was like 10 years, right? 86 to 96, run.
Yeah.
Before you guys came back in 2005.
Yeah.
And then what was that, you know, how did that journey start to feel? Like, Temple of Low Men, by the way, was my senior year of high school. K-Rock was in full swing back then, and that cassette tape was just in my car for almost that entire year.
Great. Well, so, yeah, that one didn't get as much attention as the first one in the end, but it was, yeah, it's one of my favorites.
And what do you think contributed to that? Was it sort of the end of a decade and the music business shifting, or was it, what do you think it was?
Well, I don't know for sure. I think maybe the second album is always a difficult one to pull off. You don't have as much time. I think the songs were a little darker. Ironically, it was an easy album to make. We made it very easily. We enjoyed making it. It wasn't a struggle. In fact, the first album was more of a struggle. It sounds more like a fun record. And also maybe Better Be Home Soon was the single we put out from it, and we all thought that was going to go all the way, but it sort of stalled, and then the capital ran out of ideas, I think. So that's a far more detailed, businessy kind of answer than I should have given you,
no,
really.
That was a good answer.
I don't know, man. It's just a record. You know,
no, I don't know. Who knows? Well, it's interesting to hear you say, because, yes, Temple of Low Men was a tonally darker record, but I thought Woodface was more seemed to be more upbeat, you know? You had
– We came at – yeah.
Pineapple Head seemed like a more upbeat song. I don't know if it
– Yeah, Weather With You was a real upbeat song. And, yeah. You know, it was a real bright, breezy song.
She Goes On.
Yeah.
Lovely, beautiful
Thank
song.
You. Yeah.
So what – I mean, at that point, did you make the conscious decision, or was it just emotionally like that's where you were at by the time Woodface came out in 91?
The songs just come out the way they come out. And, you know, there's a little bit of afterthought you can put into the construction of the album and where to put what to put first and all that in order to create an impression. But really, the songs, yeah, you're just thankful for each one that comes that has a feeling attached to it. And in some cases, they're upbeat. The ones that Woodface – some of the ones that were the more upbeat songs on Woodface came as a result of Tim and I, my brother, writing songs together for the first time. And they weren't even meant for the album at first, but our solution to having two bodies of songs and two albums potentially in the go and neither of them finished or constructed was just to combine the whole thing, you know, the simple solution. Oh, Tim, just join the band and then we'll do all the songs together and you'll be in Crowded House. Sounds simple, right?
But you know, people are complicated. You know, like people relationships are complicated.
Well, it mostly just didn't fit quite as well on stage because we have different ways of approaching it. Inhibited our. We had a three-piece thing going on. You know, like where we were able to really make our shows pretty loose and wild, and the banter was really understood. And Paul would always, you know, be there with a punchline if I left something hanging. And but having another strong presence on stage just meant we were kind of going, oh no, sorry, you'd be talking on top of each other all of
right.
a sudden. And that sounds like a strange way to describe a problem, but it is. But it inherently became just a little bit of a problem. So, and he felt it as well. He didn't feel like he was fully engaged. And yeah, but the album benefited from those songs. And, you know, we make music, we have done since, and we do it with a great deal of joy still. And we're kind of better when we come back to it from time to time rather than doing it all the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
When you look back at the albums now, is it sort of a diary of your life at the time? Do you look back and go, oh, I guess I really was going through this and I didn't realize it at the time, but that's what this album was saying. Do they all kind of say something special to you?
There's things in there, each song that are true, but there's also fantasy. Well, you know, there's imaginings, there's just a little bit of kind of skullduggery. I don't know if that's a term that people are familiar with here, but... yeah, just to get a song to feel like there's a person. I always like to disengage from the song at some point and go, well, there may be some truth from my life in this, but I want to imagine I'm a character singing the song. I don't want to be feeling like I'm, you know, exposing my innermost thoughts
sure.
all the time. But then if you can get if you can get the people to believe that I'm exposing my innermost thoughts, then that's a real success. So there's sort of a dichotomy. And I don't want people to read them as diaries, but I'm also quite flattered when they do because it means that they've actually connected and listened. And
sure.
Yeah, so I haven't figured that one out quite yet.
Well, there's a little bit of a Rorschach thing going on. I mean, like, you know, people will – I'm sure people tell you, oh, your song means this. And you go, oh, okay, I guess if it means that for you, I suppose it does.
Yeah, that's very true. And I wouldn't want to interrupt that process for anybody. I like leaving a series of doors open and people can wander into whichever one they want. You know.
Sure.
So my lyrics are a little bit open-ended, elliptical or whatever is the current journalistic expression for that kind of lyric writing. I'm not alone there. I have a certain great admiration for people like Randy Newman or who can tell us an amazing story in a very lucid and coherent way. I was talking to Mitchell Froome yesterday, who's been working with Randy, and I was, as we all do, we look to the you know, the guy in the next paddock and go, wow, I wish I could do that. And it sounds so effortless. And he says, oh, Randy, he really works hard. As far as Randy's concerned, music's really hard.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of how much work you can put into getting things the right the way. And he'd be changing lines right to the very end. So I take great comfort from that. It's not that I ever would expect to be able to reach a point where he does, but I'm also tweaking and working on things till the very end of the process, there was a chance of transformation, you know.
Sure.
And I'm happy to abandon ideas and actually destroy things, throw them up in the air and wreck, you know. It's something I've spent a week on. It's actually quite a joyous feeling to throw it out in a really unceremonious way and just keep one little aspect of it that you know is the right part, you know.
Yeah. Well, and also once you, you know, you do the album and then you tour and then you've played the song hundreds of times, do you ever think, oh, it kind of evolved this way. Boy, I wish I could go back and kind of redo that one now that I've done it this many times.
Sometimes that happens on stage. You really hit some heights, yeah. And in fact, it almost always happens because you'll have a night that's like just a transcendent night with an audience in front of you, and you'll play every song. You feel like every beat or every quarter beat is you can control and use to your advantage. You know, you've just got that much. It's like a microscopic detail. As much, you're not actually having to be conscious of it, but you can sense that you're hearing music in a very microscopic way. And yeah, and you find little revelations about songs that you weren't aware of when you recorded them. So, but you know, that's sometimes the recorded version will always have a certain magic that you can't recreate as well. So, you know, it goes both ways.
Is there a specific guide to a band breaking up? Is there a moment of, we're not doing this anymore, or you kind of just stop calling each other or agents communicate? Like, so when Crowded House breaks up in 1996, how does that manifest? Is it just maybe we shouldn't do this anymore? Or did everyone kind of feel it was coming?
Every band's probably different. Bands are like, the reason that they break up mostly, and that's a rare beast that continues on for a long time, is because you really, as you become an older, it suits a young young man or a young woman's life to, when you're not really attached or you're reasonably free and, you know, no, you don't have kids. And
yeah.
I had kids early, so it was a little different for me. But as soon as you become an adult, you know, like in your 30s or whatever, the amount of compromise and allowance that you need to make for people's personalities and egos and sensitivities becomes overwhelming for some people. I don't know that that's exactly the reason it happened. Paul Hester left Crowded House in Atlanta. Funnily enough, there's a little strange echo of Split Enz before I joined. One of the original members was called Phil Judd, and he was one of the writers and a key part of the early band. He left in Atlanta as well. Huh. So there's something about that town.
Was it like in the middle of a tour?
That was Prince's last show, right?
Was it the last show in Atlanta?
I think it was the last show in Atlanta. But anyway, there's something about that town.
There's something about Atlanta that's like, we're done.
And it's not a negative thing necessarily. It was for us, but we had amazing shows in Atlanta, I hasten to add, and have done since. But yeah, there's a...
Even the area code of Atlanta is 404, which is the error you get when a website does not have a file that you're looking for.
Oh, this is too spooky.
It's going too deep. It's going too deep. There's some type of energy under Atlanta. But he left in the middle of a tour, you said?
He did. And he had... he had lost a little bit of heart for the whole thing. And he'd become not... You know, because he's one of the funniest guys I've ever known and a great friend. And when he was on, as he mostly was... he was capable of transforming a room with laughter and, you know, and a great drummer and all that. Everything you'd want from somebody in your band. But he just lost a bit of heart for it. And by the time we got to Atlanta, he was actually deeply affected by Kurt Cobain dying. It happened about a week before he left. And I just think it came at a certain time where it was really depressing. He found it really, really depressing, and he was not being... he was about to have a baby. It was all these things that had combined for him. And he left, and we kept going out of stubbornness, and because we just didn't want to let that, you know. And we did some great shows, and we went and tried to make some new songs, but there was something about had upset the chemistry, and I thought, well, if this is a different beast now, I didn't feel like... And I had the same feeling when Split Enz broke up. I said, there's a lot of baggage now to continue on. I'd like to have a fresh slate and be able to work with people still. Collaboration, as I said, is a really key thing for me, but... I didn't want to be limited by being in a band.
Sure.
I'm envious of bands that can stay on with their original lineups. It's you know, I have a great affection for that whole concept.
I mean, I guess the grass is always greener on both sides. You know, you stay with one band and then you can grow in new ways. But then when you don't, then, you know, you have all sorts of new chemistries to discover with new collaborations. Yeah. And
that's right. And that doesn't always mean that you get – that it's sometimes more confusing for people because they don't know what, you know, where to place you anymore. A band has a nice convenient thing, umbrella to put – people's feelings, memories, attachments, periods of time under this band name, you know, like,
yeah.
It's a mysterious thing. I have people that will say to me, I only like you when you do Crowded House things.
I
don't say it quite as blatantly as that, but they basically say that.
You know, for the internet, I'm sure it's people do talk that blatantly. Like,
but sometimes they do.
Do more of this.
Occasionally, I bristle a little bit, and I shoot back a kind of a barb.
Oh, you
and
do?
And they get really kind of upset about it and go, oh, I didn't realize you were such a – and I thought you were a good guy, but you know, no. And I say, look, I tell you what, if you've bought records that you're not enjoying because they're not cool, send them to me. I'll give you a refund.
Yeah.
And I, so far, have no one sent one.
I would say the same thing too. Like, hey, fine, you're not happy? Let me just make this right for you.
Yeah.
You know, and then you won't be able to be upset
anymore. Yeah, then
stop bugging me. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I think one of the things that I always, because, you know, so much of my young life was devoted to comedy and every comedy, everything I could get my hands on. And I could tell very quickly that you guys were funny guys. I could tell that you guys, you know, and particularly like you said, Paul, he always kind of had that sort of like smirk and the gleam, like, okay, yeah, these guys have some sort of comedic appreciation.
Well, we found that one of the ways of coping with, you know, sometimes fairly mindless sort of activity that you have to embark on as a band, you know, photo sessions and interviews and TV and stuff. Our way of coping with that was by subverting as much as we possibly could. And even on stage, you know, like, we always loved it when things went wrong. And we had an ability to the banter between us was unforced and made every show distinct from the last. You know, like, be able to remember, somebody would say, oh, well, I was there the night that you examined one of the people in the front row, examined their handbag and did a commentary on that. And, oh, I remember that, you know. So you remember the nights and their little points of memory, and people know if they're going to come to see you, they're not going to get remotely the same show that they saw last time. I think
right.
That's important for me anyway.
Well, I think it's also why, which you may or may not want to hear about this, but, you know, why the sort of the Crowded House bootleg was such a thing, you know, among Crowded House fans. We were like, oh my God, I got this one show, you know. I mean, I would trade shows with, like, oh, I got this one from 1989. Great. Oh, I got this one from here. And then you would hear the distinct differences in the way the songs were presented. It was just like, everything was just a little bit, yeah, no two shows ever really sounded alike.
Yeah, we had somebody at the fan club put out a record of just banter. I can't remember what it was called. It might have been called I Like to Watch or something. I don't remember now, but it was quite entertaining. I mean, I haven't listened to it for a long time, but yeah. When Paul was on fire, he was really unstoppable, you know, and I still like another reason, probably like Largo, it has a lot of humor. There's a lot of humor possible there, and, you know, we're still fishing for those moments, drawing the audience in a little bit.
Yeah, and
like a good heckler.
Yeah, oh, you do like the heckler.
I don't mind it. Well, I mean, you know, as you would know well, I'm sure, there's good hecklers and there's bad hecklers,
yes.
You know. There's people who feed you lines.
Yes.
And you can rib, you know, and take the piss out of, and they take it well. And there's people who just want to unnerve you.
Or they're just drunk. Oh, my God.
Or they're just drunk, yeah.
You just reminded me.
Sometimes both.
When I was at the House of Blues show, there was a guy who would not stop screaming Johnny Marr's name.
Oh, yeah.
Who, it just went Johnny... Just in the middle, for
so
no reason.
Annoying.
Johnny Marr!
So annoying.
He said it, like, legitimately, and he seemed like the kind of guy, like, maybe I shouldn't tell him to stop. He kind of seemed like a drunken...
It can go horribly wrong when you focus on those people, the wrong person, because they take it as a, you know, it emboldens them.
Right.
And they become more and more unpleasant. And most of the audience are not that... focused in on it, so you already lose an audience quite easily. I'm sure it's the same in your
field.
But
in a venue the size of the House of Blues, when it was, you know, on Sunset, it was like, it's not like it wasn't a giant venue.
It dominates the room.
It does dominate the room, and I think there's a certain point where you sort of hope, like, I hope the crowd kind of turns on this guy.
That often happens. It's quite good when they do. You know, not that you want another drunk guy to think it's his role to actually give my smack in the teeth or something.
Right.
But it is quite good when the audience sort it out themselves, and they often do, yeah.
Well, when you did the solo stuff, again, Try Whistling This and One All, which I think was 1-0 in everywhere else in the world, right?
Yeah, it came out a little later here, and I thought by then I should add a couple of songs to it, and I called it One All. Yeah.
One All, yeah. And also in America, we don't use the word nil, really.
Well, no, and anyway, everything in America has to be different. You know, like, right. You got American football, we got rugby.
Right.
You got baseball, we got cricket.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I know. You know, because we're basically like the, hey, we can do stuff too. You know, like, we, for some reason, we constantly have to feel like we have to prove something.
A slightly different name to some Americanization is necessary, yeah.
It is a little bit necessary to feel
it
like,
is.
This is our thing.
Yeah, that's
this
right.
This is kind of our own thing.
Hey, I'm hip to that. That's
do you
cool.
like, it, so you said you like collaboration, but is it important for you to sit down sometimes alone and really just kind of do stuff yourself?
Well, all the songs, pretty much, unless I'm writing with my brother or, in this case now, recently with Liam, my son, I start the process on my own, and it's a real just a dreaming, imagining, you know, drifting away, often on quite banal things, and then all of a sudden, just by turning up every day, you get a good idea. That's all a really solitary thing, and I'll make a demo, or maybe a series of demos sometimes, actually, to get myself into what the atmosphere of the record might sound like, and that keeps me going, basically, just keeps me moving forward.
Do you feel impatient ever with the, just because of the way that media can be delivered instantaneously to people now? Do you ever have to stop yourself if you just record something really fast? Go, I was going to put this on the internet. Just do you feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that? Or maybe do you feel more pressure that it has to be very presentational before you put something out? Or do you ever just think, oh, I'll just put this one little weird thing out?
Well, I mean, I have had that that temptation on many occasions to just put something straight out there, and I have resisted so far because the chances are that most things you do like that is going to disappear without trace, and then you might have a moment's pleasure and, like, you know, your 100 responses are going, yeah, we love this, and then so it's, you know, like, it's hard to know how to get noticed out there. I love the immediacy of that idea. I think I'm going to try something next year, which is a new thing for me, which I won't even talk about because some other bastard will steal the idea.
But, you know, I'll tell you what, though. If you kind of talk about it a little bit here, then you have proof that you said it first. If you don't say it,
that
someone
also
else
occurred
does
to
it,
me, yeah.
Then if you don't say it and then someone else does it, you can't go, well, that was the thing I was talking about. People go, well, I didn't hear you say that.
But if I do say it on your show, will you then stand up and publicly, you know, take someone down for
Neil,
it?
Neil, I am so much your fan. I will track that person down and beat the living shit out of them, and I don't know how to fight. I will hire people to do it.
Yeah.
Because that's the point I am in my life.
Well, I'm still now faced with the predicament of whether I tell you about it or just hint at something.
If you say it and then later you regret it, I'll take it out. And I'll never tell a soul.
No, like, I'm actually didn't even worry about this, but there's a couple of people I know who have been aware that there's a lot of pirates out there who steal ideas, you know. And it's a great trait for anybody contemporary, really.
But you know what else? Yeah. No one else is you. The way that Neil Finn would do something is not the way anyone else would do it.
Well, I like the idea of constructing an event that is the making of a record. Not in a traditional sense, but creating an event and having that be completely live and people get the whole thing. They get to be part of the whole thing, and they get the record.
That's a spectacular idea. And I swear, even if it doesn't even matter who else would ever do that idea, it would never be the experience that you would create.
Well, no, and the detail of that is possibly what sets it apart a little bit. Anyway, it's just a nice – I've got a bunch of songs at the moment, two or three records that are circling and ready to go, almost ready to go. I don't know which one's going to arrive first, but that is one very appealing idea for this particular bunch of songs, that it would be nice to be able to create an event around them and then – have people be able to be part of that event.
Are you?
I'm not talking about a live album.
No. Do you ever get caught up in how caught up do you get in the sort of the presentation and the naming of an album and the art of an album and how people are gonna? Do you get caught up in all that stuff, or you go, no, I write the songs. Someone else can worry about that stuff.
Well, you got to be a little bit involved, because otherwise you end up with a really dorky photo of yourself on the cover, or some idiot's written a press release that's got nothing to do with you, you know. And
because that's all the businessy stuff that I think when you're young, you don't really want to think about.
It's always good to keep a heart. I mean, actually, nowadays I think I've always been concerned about that, because you don't want. I mean, the traditional hype record company PR release was an embarrassment, you know.
And right.
You had to write – I sort of would either write myself or get somebody I knew to write them that I knew was going to be as if you were speaking, representing you. Nowadays, though, people are so much in control of their social media. I don't know how they get time to write or do anything, because there's so much
– such a responsibility.
And, you know, there's obscure artists in New Zealand who've got more likes on their Facebook page than I have that I've never heard of, and they've just got this whole social media thing going.
Sure.
I'm in awe of it in a way. It's because it seems like there's a generational – an evolutionary jump happening amongst – whether or not it's all really positive, I can't say. But young people seem incredibly smart about presenting themselves in the world. And,
they are, but I do wonder how much value a lot of – so, you know, you see someone, it's like, oh, my God, they have, you know, a million likes on this thing. Mm. They might – I still am not 100% sure how that necessarily translates. Like, if that person were to tour, I don't think it, you know, I don't think the math checks out that, like, you know, no. A million people would show up.
No, it's an empty statistic without some kind of context built around it, I think. Yeah, that's true. And I don't actually spend a lot of time worrying about it. I've got the only social media I do is Twitter, and the only reason I started doing it was because I was bored in a hotel, an airport lounge with a delayed flight. And I started it for entertainment purposes for myself and hopefully for other people. And I'd like to think that's mostly the reason I still do it. There's a few times where I'll put a poster link for a show or something, but mostly it's just if I have a, you know, late at night and I've had a couple of wines and I have a funny notion about something. And that's, to me, the only reason to do it. I know that I could, that people approach it in a far more clinical thing, but it seems very boring to me.
Yeah, and also just too much. It's just a lot of work. It's just a lot of work. It's too much responsibility, and it saps so much creative energy.
Yeah, I'm not on Facebook myself directly. I do, obviously, somebody does my Facebook, but hopefully no, they don't try and pretend they're me.
Well, it's a really interesting idea that you only have so much energy in your brain for things.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was so great about the advent of social media and, you know, I guess really social media and it's in the form that we know now is about 10 years old, 10 or 11 years old.
Mm.
And it was such a great way for undiscovered people. Hey, I'll get my stuff. I'll take the middleman out. I won't have some company say, okay, you're good enough to put out into the world. But I think what it has actually kind of done is sort of like what you were saying. It takes so much energy to then – you just end up marketing and not as much producing stuff.
No, actually making stuff. Yeah, making stuff in an old-fashioned sense is still so valuable. I mean, and I think they – people do with their, you know, in bedrooms and their computers now. It's like it's far more of a solo kind of endeavor, and it's amazing music being made. So I don't want to be like an old dude who goes, "Oh, things were better in my day," you know, with the good old fashioned corruption and
right. You know, when the record business could really fuck an artist over. Those were the good days.
Come on, you just used to have to give cocaine to a radio program and you were done. You know, that
was it.
Now you have to go and, you know, visit all these blogs.
Now I have to deliver cocaine to a million people on Facebook.
There's a lot of gatekeepers now, though. There is a lot of avenues, you know. I don't know whether it's still the way, but you used to do a newspaper interview, and that would just be sitting down with a journalist and with a, you know, tape recorder maybe. Now they've got a TV studio, you know, and you have to do a little session for them. And,
yes.
And it does seem like there's a lot more avenues to explore. There's probably a few key things still. Obviously, the TV shows are, you know, the big TV shows are good mass exposure, but it did seem like there was – to do all of that stuff, that you could spend your entire time promoting yourself and not have time to write or be a good human being.
What was it? Spend time with your family, live in the world, eat once in a while, take a shower and look at the sun. What was the – in the early – I guess around 2005, what was the thing that made you say, like, hey, maybe we could do Crowded House again, or maybe we could start making more stuff?
Well, I was hanging out with Nick again, and we'd obviously kept in touch and we were good friends anyway, but – just he was living in Ireland, I was living in New Zealand. In the aftermath of losing Paul Hester in a very tragic way, we kind of were drawn together. And
was that the same year? Did Paul
pass away? Later on. I was making a record at that time. I'd done it. I was touring with my brother when we were finishing off shows for the album Everyone Is Here. And then I was making a solo record, which is largely the record that came out as Crowded House record, Time on Earth. And Nick was playing bass on, you know, we just found some good comfort in each other's and enjoyed making music again after the result of that. And I sort of, you know, quite honestly, looking back, the reason that we, that I felt it was a good thing to do and a soulful thing to do was because there was this dreadful full stop on everything all of a sudden, you know, and I thought that Crowded House had put, I thought, a lot of joy in the world, and Paul had as well. And there was just this terrible, big yawning sort of abyss that opened up after losing him. And I thought, well, no, let's hang out and make music together and try and let's really spend some time trying to find a great drummer that can do some justice to the songs we did already and put some good history out there. So that was the prompt and the motivation. And we made a couple of, I think, really strong records. And I feel good about it, and it's like a thing that's sort of up on, like an old car up on blocks, you know, and it needs a little bit of attention every now and again as to turn the motor over. but we could get it out at any point. But I don't feel like now I'm again enjoying making music in a variety of different ways. So,
and it was so the reuniting was kind of therapeutic after
yeah, it was. So. And I liked it, and I think it was soulful in the sense it wasn't. We weren't out to cash in on, you know. I mean, we had a lot of interest, and we did some great shows, and we toured the world. I really don't feel like we did it as a kind of well, we better bring the old band back now because sure. You know we can make some money, and that certainly wasn't the motivation for me and or Nick. So yeah.
And then Intriguer was also a really great album too. Elephants.
Thank you.
Elephants was a beautiful, beautiful song. Every year I make a playlist that starts on my birthday and I name it after whatever my age is.
Right.
And then just throughout the year I just sort of like, I'll just throw songs that I like onto that playlist.
Have you, just for your own sake, or does it turn up on Spotify as
no,
well?
No. It's just for me. I've been doing it for almost like 15 years.
Hey, great.
So I just have 15 years and it just becomes this kind of musical diary. And there's just, you know, you or Crowded House, or it's like, it's awesome. So great how the songs will come back around again and hit you in a point in your life. You're like, oh my God, yeah, oh, I forgot. Oh, this song. Oh yeah, that's right. Oh, and now it's meaningful now.
Well, I feel completely and utterly blessed that is the way that songs work because, I when you write them, and then they even come back for me as well. Like I'll go out and I say, I haven't played this song for 10 years, and I'll play it on piano where it used to be on guitar, and I'll suddenly go, oh wow, this is actually a hot, completely fresh thing for me now. It kind of blows my mind, you know, like it is connected to the past. It has some nostalgia attached to it, but it's also a living, breathing thing that.
Yeah.
And people tell me about, you know, always about moments in their life where certain songs were valuable to them, and in some ways, mysterious ways that I couldn't have predicted. And yeah, you just thank your lucky stars to be part of that process.
What's your most surprising collaboration that you pulled off? Like someone that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I got to play with that person.
Well, I mean, at the time, there's a guy in Australia called Michael Lunig. Do you know him? He's a really great cartoonist and kind of philosopher cartoonist. He would be accessible via the internet. Very much loved in Australia. And I did a tour with him. And the Australian Chamber Orchestra, a guy called Richard Tognetti, who's got great, amazing small chamber orchestra, and a children's choir, and a series of really odd, like an electronic musician from Sydney who does really strange things, who had the whole mix going through his fridge, you know, his electronic fridge. That was an absolutely amazing experience because and that was 10 years ago now, but it pulled me right out of, I'd never done anything like that remotely. Suddenly scoring or writing songs for a children's choir. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I love, particularly now more than anything. I enjoyed working with – I've got a great arranger in New Zealand called Victoria Brown, who's an amazing – we work really well together, and she does great string arrangements. So I'm really enjoying that process. The broader palette is really fun for me at the moment. So, anything that drags you out of, you know, the narrow parameters of pop music is really good, I think.
And for you, I would imagine creatively, you just need to keep it fresh to freshen up every so often.
Yeah, you've just got to keep your brain. It's, you know, brain plasticity as it is. You know, like you learn a few new skills. So it's important for anybody. I think if you're just repeating the same old things, you just end up like Ozzy, you know.
Well, what is the thing? No, it's fine. I know exactly what you mean, though. I know exactly what you mean. What do you feel like after all this time when you look back? Like, what did you learn? What do you learn about your music, or what do you learn about yourself, or what do you learn? You know, I'm asking because a lot of people are creative types who listen to the podcast, and I'm sure they're just starting out or they're trying to figure out their thing or find their voice. Mm. You know, if you were to tell a young Neil Finn, like, hey, psst, by the way, you know, do this, don't do this, don't worry about this, worry about this.
Well, I mean, just turning up is, you know, like as simple as that sounds, turning up every day and working every day, if you can, it's super important, I think. Because most of the time nothing's going to happen, but you're going to be able to notice when good things happen far more. You're tuned in. And you know, it's like that with anything. The more you do it, the better you get at it. It's just as simple as that. It's a mystery. The moment of inspiration is a mystery, but the means of getting there shouldn't necessarily have to be. Apart from that, God, I don't know, really. Well, I wouldn't do anything that much different And the other collaboration, like doing Seven Worlds was the other thing that I would say that that's, I think, putting yourself in a dangerous states and difficult positions as a musician is really healthy as well. You can play to your comfort zone endlessly. And people that are, I think, spending too much time in their bedroom, that's what happens a lot these days. Sure. People are making records in there. I think get it out in the light.
Yeah.
You know, play it for people. When you circle around with your own ideas for too long, it just gets really claustrophobic in there. So, yeah, make sure you've got someone you can play your music to and play it for real as much as you can.
So when does the Crowded House reissue come out?
I think November.
Okay.
All of them. They might be available pretty soon. I'm actually not 100% sure that I know those dates real soon. And I think it'll be available in the US through a Universal. I know are packaging it all up because they now own all that stuff.
Is it coming out as one big like box set, or is it? Or they're just all being reissued?
It's not actually. I mean, there was talk of an actual box. I mean, really, it comes down to it's just going to be a box.
Right.
That's the difference. All the records are available. They've all every single one of our records is accompanied by on CD is accompanied by an extra bonus CD of rarities, demos, notable performances from stage. It's a pretty tasty little package, actually. We put a lot of effort into making sure everything earned its place, all those rarities. I don't want to undo any of the mystery of what makes the record stand as they stand,
sure.
But there is some quite interesting little glimpses into the way that songs travel and what happens to them along the way and where they come from. My demos I'm very fond of, so I'm kind of happy people are hearing those. They will all be – you could put a box in them, and we may even have one standing by that I'm not even aware of.
They're all going to be – there's going to be a little box in the shape of a house.
Yeah.
And all the CDs are going to be crowded
well,
inside.
Well, I hope we have got – that sort of got – now that I'm aware, I've got – that got lost. We talked about that a while ago, and I got lost in the detail of what we were doing. I don't know. There might still be a box.
There could be a box.
You can make your own. I think if somebody makes a great box – I'm going to put a really good package, a really good prize together for you.
And then fill that box with some really good stuff.
Make your own box, send in a photo or something, and I will make sure that you get tickets to the next year's shows.
I will do that myself.
Really?
Are you playing in LA anytime soon? Are you doing any Largo shows this time?
I am doing Largo show on Sunday and on Tuesday. When does this go to?
When do you want to put it out? I think we were going to put it out closer to the reissue,
sure.
so that people
that
could
great.
Hear it.
Well, we will have done them, which is probably good because they sold out anyway.
Turned out great.
You're welcome to come. I might add.
I would love to. I would absolutely.
We're
love
doing
to.
Sunday and Tuesday, so take your pick.
Tuesday would be great because I have to work Sunday. And you know, Flanny and I email every once in a while, and because I just miss the community of Largo.
I love it there too.
I've been so busy, but. You agreed to play some songs, and I'm in this very strange position that I never thought I'd be in, which is when, you know, how often do you think, oh, I'm sitting down with one of my musical heroes, and he's like, hey, I'll play whatever you want. And then I go, well, shit. So I actually had to, I'll tell you what, I made a list of a bunch of my favorite Neil Finn / Crowded House songs. And if any, you know, Lullaby Requiem was pretty great.
No
big deal. I'll tell you what. I'm going to read you the list. If any of them jump out at you, I am totally fine with any of these, all right?
I haven't played that one for a long time, so I might struggle with the lyrics.
No worries. I have Whispers and Moans,
mm-hmm.
Sister Madly, In the Lowlands,
mm-hmm.
Never Be the Same, Not the Girl You Think You Are.
Oh, yeah.
So good. Pineapple Head, Love, Elephants, Driving Me Mad, Solo, Lullaby Requiem, She Goes On, Woodface, Hole in the River, fucking amazing song. She Will Have Her Way, really, and then Sinner.
Well, I mean, I can do some of them. Some of them actually, the ones that are a little bit tricky, but I could probably manage any of them, really. Of those ones you mentioned,
Hole in the River.
I've never played it on a guitar, but I could.
Would work. That's a fun.
Yeah, I'm happy to have a crack at anything, actually, to be honest. So that I.
Great.
I'll see. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. All right, this is a special request for Chris, which I normally play on piano, but I'm going to play on guitar today. Because that's all I got.
There's no piano here.
Yeah. So listener requires good imagination at a certain point in the song. I'll try and supply a few bare bones.
There's a hole in the river. touched by a cold wind. My father and I sound of desperate breathing, a fear inside us all. She was coming to see him. Something changed her mind. Drove her down to the river. There is no return.
Going to be the cameraman. I'm amazed that anybody's asking me, because people don't ask that question anymore. They just do what they want to do. I like the way your fingers were actually in the foreground of the shot there. That was quite nice. No, it was a little... Somewhere deep inside, something's got a hold on you, and it's pushing me aside. See it stretch on forever. I know I'm right for the first time in my life, and that's why I tell you, you'd better be home soon. Stripping back the coats of lies and deception, back to nothingness, like a week in the desert. I know I'm that's why I tell you, you'd better be home soon. So don't say no, don't say nothing's wrong. When you get back home, it would cause me pain if we were to end it.
I could start again. You can depend on it. And I know I'm right for the first time in my life. And that's why I tell you, you better be home soon. That's why I tell you, you'd better be home soon. There is freedom within, there is freedom without. Try to catch the deluge in a paper cup. There's a battle ahead, many battles are lost. But you'll never see the end of the road while you're traveling with me. Hey now, don't dream it's over. When the world comes in, they come to build a wall between us. We know they won't win. Now I'm towing my car. There's a hole in the roof. My possessions are causing me suspicion, but there's no proof. Part today tales of war and of waste, but you turn right over to the TV page. Hey now, don't dream it's over. Hey now, when the world comes in, they come to build a wall between us. We know steps to the door of your heart. Only shadows ahead, barely clear in the room. Get to know the feeling of liberation and release. Well, hey now, don't dream it's over. Hey now, when the world comes in, they come to build a wall between us. We know they won't win. Did you hear that, Donald? Don't ever let them win, no.
down tree.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.